remember that thou art dust, and to dust thou shalt return.
Some combination or translation of these words are spoken around the world every Ash Wednesday. The bearers of this ash wear their humble humanity on their face, literally on their foreheads, in the form of ashes made from last year's Palm Sunday fronds. And I love that symbol, smearing the remains of our confused, premature glory as a stark reminder of our finitude and limitation. What's more is it's a public religious act, and thus a reminder to all of our common heritage of fragility. Yeah, we're resilient at times, strong, persevering. We're creative in our attempts to become anti-fragile. But all of us bookend our dusty lives with great vulnerability. Here is a physical embodied reminder of who we are. Dust. Glorious dust. You might be thinking, what? Dust? Glorious dust. Something resembling an oxymoron. But yes, glorious dust. The idea here is that there is both something marvelous about our place in the universe and something modest. We are, as theologian Gilbert Mylander titled his book on human dignity, neither beast nor god. We're the paradox of the extraordinarily ordinary. Say that 5 times fast. We are the in-between. A short poem by Marilyn Nelson gives us some imagery of scale and scope to explain this phenomenon. It's called dusting. Thank you for these tiny particles of ocean salt, pearl necklace viruses, winged protozoans, for the infinite, intricate shapes of sub-microscopic living things, for algae spores and fungus spores, bonded by vital mutual genetic cooperation, spreading their inseparable lives from equator to pole. My hand, my arm, makes sweeping circles. Dust climbs the ladder of light for this infernal endless chore, for these eternal seeds of rain. Thank you for dust. In our case, glorious dust is a helpful idiom for humility. We must hold in hand a balanced truth about ourselves, neither slipping too low into servility and self-deprecation, or floating too high into arrogance and snobbery over others. That is, we must recognize what we have in common. It seems hard to come by points of common ground in our divided culture today. But think about the common ground of, well, the ground. The Latin root for humility is humus. You crunchy composters know what I'm talking about. Humus, or soil, earth. And another word with the same root? Human. I'm Evan Rosa, and you're listening to The Table Audio, a podcast about seeking Christian wisdom for life's big questions. Could it be that humility is the most expressive of what it means to live an excellent human life? Maybe, if it keeps us so deeply connected to what we truly are and how we ought to think of ourselves in relation to others. And in this episode, we'll be talking about the social elements of humility, what it means to appreciate the other, the stranger, and the common dignity of us dust bunnies, and political humility. Is that an oxymoron? What does it look like when humility finds its way into politics? This is a second installment of my interview with Krista Tippett, voice of the award-winning radio and podcast program On Being, and author of Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. I'm an avid listener and must give credit. I first heard that poem, Dusting, which I really love, in an interview Krista had with its author, Marilyn Nelson. Krista's overall project could be described as sparking civil conversations through generous listening. There are a host of moral and intellectual virtues that lie beneath that effort. And when we spoke, I was curious about her technique for sparking her own civil conversations found in the program. She asks every single person she interviews, what was the spiritual background of your childhood?
The origin of the question is in an oral history project I did for, you know, an ecumenical institute that no one will have heard of in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota. And this little ecumenical institute in the mid-20th century, when ecumenism was revolutionary, this little institute helped people of many traditions, including Christian traditions that you know, like the one I grew up in, which has a theology, a doctrine, or an interpretation of Scripture that says everybody's not going to heaven, right? And yet even those traditions, the people in those traditions needed, you know, are living in a world of you know, what I want to call is the mystery of the religious other, right? You know, being exposed to people who are planted in a very different place and yet clearly have lives of beauty and grace and integrity. So what they had learned that they could have a really eclectic gathering of people, and I mean, you know, Nazarene holiness to Armenian Orthodox, right? I mean, all Christian, technically all part of the same family, but could not be more different from each other. And they could humanize doctrine, that they could let the doctrine in its fullness be in the room, but put faces and voices and lives of integrity to nuances of that doctrine, to differences, and start a relationship that was about something different than defining oneself over against or having an argument or a debate.
It starts with the person.
Yeah, and it started with, so they had this method that I experienced it. I went to, you know, a couple of consultations and where they would have a theological question. And one thing I have to say is you had 5 days with a group of people to do this. So everybody really got to speak and be heard, and there was reflection. Mm-hmm. But the question would
be,
you know, here's the theological question. Answer the question through the story of your life. And it did not lose any of the gravitas or heft or complexity that, you know, and a lot of these people were theologians that they would bring to it. But it insisted on you speaking out of your life and your experience and not speaking for your tradition or for God, but merging ideas and beliefs and experience, you know, what you believe and who you are. And the messiness of that intersection.
Absolutely.
And so that's where that came from. I experienced it to just completely take what in other settings would be an acrimonious or suspicious gathering and create something very rich and spacious and full of possibility and full of creativity and humanity. So I just kind of adapted that when I started doing the radio show. The way I started adapting that was, as I'm saying this, it doesn't seem like a direct line, but, you know, the way it started, it came to me was asking people, I couldn't ask people to answer a theological question through the story of their life or any question through the story of their life because we didn't have 5 days, right? But I could ask this question about the spiritual background of your childhood, which... So to your question of what that affects, it may not sound dramatically different from asking somebody about their spiritual life, but it is. You know, that question of, you know, what's your spiritual life? Are you religious? Do you believe in God? Who is God? As someone asked me recently, those questions immediately freeze us because they're so enormous. I mean, it's hard to put words around those things, and they're so intimate. But to ask somebody, anybody, and I've asked people who are, you know, physicists, atheists, you know, people with all kinds of and manner of spiritual or religious background, you know, what was the religious or spiritual background of your childhood? Everyone has a story.
It's disarming.
It invites people into a soft, searching place in that each of us inhabits, which is full of questions and wonderful questions, and questions that I have found people have often followed in some indirect way their whole lives long.
You said once
you can disagree with someone's argument or their conclusion, but you can't disagree with their experience.
Yeah. Yeah. You just take it in.
More and more work has been done in recent years on the benefits of intellectual virtues or cultivating good minds for making better progress in public discourse, civil conversations, right? The idea here is that quite apart from the specific beliefs and ideas we have, say matters of policy debate, the stuff we all disagree about and that ends up dividing us, if we were to work on growing more excellent minds that embody humility, measured open-mindedness, better habits of listening and attentiveness, then we could experience improved public life for everyone, and we'd all get closer to truth and goodness. Well, I asked Krista about intellectual humility, the acknowledgement of our limitations in the face of demanding certainty. And if this doesn't sound challenging to you, think about it. Admitting to our cognitive limitations, the limits of our own powers of knowledge, as an article, a central component of Christian faith.
Yeah. You talk on, this is from page 187 in your book. At their Orthodox course, all of our traditions insist on a reverence for what we do not know now and cannot tie up with explanation in this lifetime.
Yeah.
This is an invitation to bring the particularities and passions of our identities into common life while honoring the essential mystery and dignity of the other, and to do so not as an adjunct to faithfulness, but as an article of it.
Yeah.
What we don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is another common ground.
And it's a lack of humility. It is a flaw of character when we don't let that be part of our faithfulness.
Hmm. So really in the realm of religious belief then, this is perhaps to talk about humility specifically in its intellectual domain, right? The humility with respect to our beliefs, the content of our beliefs, being willing to say, I could be wrong. What have you seen humility do in religious conversation, in the task of faithfulness?
Yeah, well, I think it can be a tricky thing. You know, I think we have cultural ways of approaching difference, and one of them is that people often go into settings where you're confronted with difference with an idea that there's some kind of expectation that either you're going to change other people's minds or they're going to change your mind. And especially when you're dealing with matters of religious identity and fidelity, that's, you know, it's not even respectful. But what I do see, there's this great paradox of actual, you know, ecumenical and interreligious encounter that is deep and meaningful and genuine. And the paradox is that people at one and the same time find that their sense of the world and often of mystery is enlarged. That they are given gifts of beauty and understanding that they didn't have before. Like they've learned things from this other person and their tradition.
Right.
But there's almost always this move at exactly the same time of feeling also more richly planted in the ground on which you stand. Like understanding your own tradition better, bringing better questions and insights that actually illuminate your own tradition in ways that you would not have considered before.
Yeah. Which is the benefit of a conversation. It's what it looks like to be genuinely involved in a successful conversation.
Yeah. And you're not actually giving anything up. You know, you're getting bigger.
Yeah. And yet there's that risk, right? I mean,
yeah, and you're entering unknown territory, which just for us as creatures is always, you know, it's slightly frightening, unnerving. And that's normal. That's okay that it feels that way.
For this segment of the interview with Krista, we ended by talking about politics. Watch out, I know. Regardless of who you voted for, where you fall in the increasingly polarized spectrum between progressives and conservatives, is there space for humility in politics? I played a couple of clips of a politician talking about his own humility last episode. What does humble political engagement actually look like. I'm a fan of what's happening in a project called Humility and Conviction in Public Life out of the University of Connecticut. And their project leader and philosopher, Michael Lynch, recently wrote, "Being intellectually humble also means taking an active stance. It means seeing your worldview as open to improvement by the evidence and experience of other people. Being open to improvement is more than just being open to change. And it isn't just a matter of self-improvement, using your own genius to know even more. It is a matter of seeing your view as capable of improvement because of what others contribute." I like the use of active stance, as Lynch says, to describe the disposition of intellectually humble people. And the social component of humility really emerges here insofar as politics is a joint effort to secure the flourishing of the polis, our common life, the public space that we all occupy and are dedicated to. And so, of course, being open to what others contribute is absolutely essential.
I wanted to ask you about, I mean, what are your thoughts about this apparent oxymoron, a humble politics?
Oh, it's not what we see modeled currently. That's not a very controversial statement, is it? It's just a fact. I think that it is modeled in many places at a local level, but it's not at the most visible, most highly most dysfunctional level, which partly because it's so dysfunctional also is most highly publicized. It's not what we see. It's also not what's rewarded. And that I think we have to take in as much as we want to criticize politics and politicians. People who are running for office or in office who admit mistakes or change their mind are reviled for that. I don't quite understand that dynamic. Like, I can't say that I feel – I was going to say it's not a reaction I have, but that's not true. I think it depends on what I think of the politician and what they're recanting on.
Sure.
So the work of creating a humble politics is not just about electing different people. There's this great line of Abraham Joshua Heschel, in a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible. And so if we're talking about creating a humble politics, and maybe, you know, just maybe we're in the midst of this wild and, discouraging and frightening political moment, I mean, kind of globally. But I hope that actually the good news about this is that it is so unsettling. That where we thought we were supposed to look for guidance is just so broken that we will understand that we have to take this back, you know, that politics belongs to all of us, that common life is bigger than politics and belongs to all of us. And maybe this is a moment for an opening where we start asking a question like that.
I love this idea of just framing it locally.
Yeah. But
it kind of turns us toward our neighbors.
There are good people on school boards and who are mayors and on city councils and we need
and
to honor
them. And they do it without
them.
They do it without all the fanfare. They do it without all the press coverage.
Well, see, this is an irony of humility is all over the place. There are good, humble, wise people, but they are the last people to draw attention to themselves. So they're the last people that so those lives don't get the publicity and they don't get noticed. And this also, to me, puts the responsibility back on all the rest of us, you know, to be creating and inhabiting the world we want to belong to. It's not, you know, and this is good news. We don't actually have to create everything from scratch, but there is this step of being intentional and opening our eyes and our ears and deciding to look for that which is quiet and humble and redemptive, but is not, you know, throwing itself in front of cameras and microphones.
So I'm going to get off the mic here and call it a day. If you're interested in listening to more of Krista, of course, check out onbeing.org and subscribe to On Being's podcasts. And she'll be back in another future episode of The Table Audio to discuss spiritual geniuses of the everyday, developing a vocabulary of love, and learning to acknowledge and hold the pain of others. Thanks for listening, my fellow humus dwellers. The Table Audio is hosted by me, Evan Rosa, and is produced by the Biola University Center for Christian Thought, which is supported by generous grants from the John Templeton Foundation, Templeton Religion Trust, and the Blankenmeyer Foundation, along with people like you who care about seeking Christian wisdom for life's big questions. Theme music is by The Brilliance. Special thanks to Krista Tippett, Lily Percy, and Chris Hegel over at On Being. It's an honor to work with them. To subscribe to The Table Audio, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search The Table Audio. And really, it'll help us so much if you leave a review in Apple Podcasts. Leave us a comment. Let us know what you think. You can follow me on Twitter at @EvanSubRosa, and you can follow the Center for Christian Thought at @BiolaCCT or visit cct.biola.edu.